introduction. I can hardly wait to hear what I've got to say. That's about the best I've ever received. Now, I'll probably stand up here and fall flat on my face, and you'll wonder, what in the world did he say so many nice things about this guy for? Well, I'm really happy to be here. Actually, I've only been in the Dalles for about 2 hours now, but already I've fallen in love with your scenery and your magnificent Columbia River. And beyond that, I've already begun to know some of you wonderful people, and I hope to come back again sometime. Now, actually, I can't think of anything worse to invite to an occasion of this kind than a preacher who is in condition. I think it's really bad to invite a preacher at all, but to invite one who's in shape seems to me to be the worst thing you could possibly do. Actually, friends, about my only claim to fame is that I am a pole-vaulting preacher, or as some people have called me, the vaulting vicar. I'm sometimes referred to as a decathlon deacon. I made a trip to Scotland a few years back, and over there they like to call me the jumping padre. I think it's really humorous to get some of the comments they make about a preacher in sport. I made this goodwill tour to Asia, and in India, I don't know how it got started, but everywhere I went in India, they all called me the ricocheting reverend. Fortune was telling me tonight they ought to call me the revolting reverend or something like that. But we've had a wonderful close tie, this fellow and I. I think the funniest one of all that they have pinned on me in terms of being a preacher in sport is the one coined by a writer in Cleveland when he claimed I was the only preacher he knew of trying to get to heaven on his own strength. Well, be that as it may, friends, I've had a lot of wonderful experiences in sports, and I'm going to talk to you tonight out of the sport world. But before I do, I would like once again to tell you about this wonderful guy on my left. We've been up and down and in and out and battled all around Europe. We've had some wonderful experiences together. We began our collegiate career together. We were on the 48 Olympic team together. In 1951, I can remember just as clear as day when I stood out beyond the world record just about 3 feet, and I yelled up and I said, "Come on, Fort, and hit me." When that guy unwound and uncorked one of the most tremendous discus throws I've ever seen, I can still see that thing leveling off and coming out, out, out. And the guy just about did hit me, going beyond me to a new world record of 185 feet 6 inches. I ought to tell you the story preceding that one, too, about a magnificently beautiful girl, but I won't do that one. But anyway, it's a funny story about a beautiful girl from Portugal that inspired him, I think. But beyond that, he fell in love with another beautiful girl in Pasadena, California, who currently is the mother of four of his children, and a wonderful wife she is to him. But after he fell in love with her, he threw it 194 feet 6 inches, So I don't know. If he was a Mormon, he'd probably throw it 304 feet. I don't know what to do with this guy. But actually, not only has he been a great discus thrower, but he's been an outstanding weight man throwing the shot over 54 feet. He can power clean 300 pounds. And if you know anything about weightlifting, you know what a phenomenon that is. He was also a sprinter in high school. He's won numerous awards. He's got some trophies all over the world. But I think the funniest one I ever saw him receive was when he threw this magnificent throw in Portugal. People ran out of the stands. They were all excited. Everyone shouting in Spanish, all kinds of language. And one guy came up with his lunch and gave him a can of sardines. Now, I think that's about the best trophy that Fortune's ever received.
He still got it.
Well, gee, I'm such a long-winded preacher. I wish I could turn him loose on you up here. I know he could say quite a few words. But let me say this, you can invite him up next year. He only lives about 80 miles from here, and he's an outstanding magician. Actually, that's the way he won his girl, you know. He walked up to this beautiful... happened to be with her. No one could even get the eyes of this girl, but Fortune started pulling rubber balls out of his coat and all kinds of handkerchiefs and everything. And in a matter of a few minutes, he had captivated her attention, her mother's attention, and to make the long story short, he broke the world record. Well, anyway... Well, that's a disconnected statement if ever I heard one, but I wish you could let this guy tell you the story. He's really terrific as a speaker. Well, now where do I go from here? I've sung his praises. I told you I was going to talk to you out of the sport world, friends, and that's exactly what I will do. Now, I hope you won't feel like I've let you down tonight. I hope you don't feel like I did what a quarterback did who was playing for Duke University. I don't know if you've heard this one, but Duke was playing Georgia Tech, and Georgia Tech was loaded for bear. They had about 8 All-Americans, and Duke had hoped to beat them in their homecoming game, Only the score at the half was 40-0 in favor of Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech really murdered them. They couldn't even get a first down. They fumbled the ball, Duke did, and they were just running around in circles. Well, unfortunately, in the third quarter, Duke got the ball again. And they didn't know what in the world to do with the thing. And the quarterback went back and he scratched his helmet and he thought, what play am I going to call now? But he had to appear brave, so he went in the huddle and the conversation went something like this. Okay, men, right half around left end. And the right half looked at him and puckered up and said, oh, no, Charlie. He said, I got a bad leg. If I get hit there, I won't be able to walk off the field. He said, okay, never mind then. Left half around right end. And the left half puckered his lips and said, oh, no, Charlie, he said, there's an All-American linebacker over there. That guy said he'd kill me if I came over there again. He said, okay, never mind, then fullback, straight up the middle. And the fullback looked at him hard and gulped and keeled over in a dead faint right in the middle of the huddle. Well, the quarterback didn't know what in the world to call. He was looking around that huddle trying to think of something when all of a sudden a punchy right guard who was weaving in and out of the huddle, he'd been worked over by a tackle on the other side and he could hardly see straight. But he reached up and hit the quarterback on the shoulder pad and said, say, Charlie, I know what let's do. Let's throw a long, incomplete forward pass. Well, now, I hope I don't do this tonight, guys. I hope that there's somebody out in this auditorium that's going to hear something of what I have to say. And I hope, metaphorically speaking, you can take it on to score in this wonderful game of life. Now, actually, if some of you heard me before, you're probably thinking, great guns, that guy gives the same speech everywhere he goes. Well, you see, I'm a lot like the preacher. That two fellows were talking about their preachers, and one of them said, great guns, my preacher just preached 288 sermons on the same text. The other guy said, man, that ain't nothing. I got a preacher that just preached 288 texts, and they're all the same sermon. Well, that's the way I am. I'm liable to give you the same sermon, the same old speech, because I just love this sport world, friends. I've come to see written large in this athletic world the great lessons of living. I maintain that what happens out there on a gridiron or a basketball court or a track, baseball diamond, a tennis court, what happens there is indicative as to what will probably happen in life. I maintain that the character a man has, his perspective, the discipline of his life, what he has to go through to become great in the sport world, the same qualities absolutely are relevant to any other realm of life. You take a guy on that football gridiron, his own 6-inch line, back to the wall, couple of seconds left to play, score tied. In a moment like that, you see into the heart of a guy. Whether he digs in with all he's got and holds that line or whether he lets down, tells you something about the man. Take a kid coming off that curve, lungs pounding, perspiration running down his body, sucking in hot air, legs numb. In a moment like that, you see more than just physiology, kids. You see the psyche. You see right into human emotion and human drive and human will. What a guy does, whether he picks those knees up and drives on for that tape or whether he slackens the pace, tells you something about what he'll do in any endeavor. Take a man struggling through the hours, whirling and whirling in a discus ring, 6 inches short of a world record through the months of disappointment and frustration, working until that thing finally does go out there. But I can tell you this, you can see it, you can feel it in the great endeavors, you can see it emerge. I saw it in a half-mile race. I'll never forget it as long as I live. 8 guys went down to their mark, 5 of them held a world record at one time or another. Men, how would you like to go down to a line knowing that the guy on your right could beat you by 6 inches? You might beat the guy on your left by a tenth of a second by a lunge into the tape. You talk about pressure, electric with anticipation. That crowd just waited as those 5 world record holders lined up shoulder to shoulder. When that gun went off, elbows jostled, men bent in, struggling for that position. In the roar of the crowd, they went around the curve, down the backstretch. Arnie Soule took the lead. His strategy to set a pace so fast he would kill everybody else off. Flawlessly, he moved down the stretch, around the curve, up the straightaway in the roar of the crowd, holding that pace with everything he had. He went by the first lap time. They rang the bell. Everyone on their feet now. Thousands of hours behind them in work. Men putting out everything they've got. Believe me, if you run, you run when 100,000 people are roaring vicariously every step of the way. Soul out in front, began to sprint around the curve, down the backstretch. That's where he made his mistake. Too soon.
Right behind him, about 3 yards back, was Tom Courtney of Fordham University. Behind Tom was Boyson, the current world record holder from Norway. Behind him, Johnson, the dark horse from Great Britain. And right behind him, Lonnie Spurrier of California. The five former world record holders blazing down that backstretch began to close the gap. They were all within a half a yard of each other. Soule began to wobble on the curve. His leg gave way. Courtney caught him right in the middle of the curve, went around him, came up into the straightaway. Just as he hit the straightaway, a terrific gust of wind blew down the thing, almost stopped him in his tracks. Tom told me this. He said, "Bob, just as that gust of wind hit me, all of a sudden I ran out of gas." Now, if any of you have ever run a race, you know what that is. That sickening feeling of fatigue. Head throbbing, numb all over, sucking in hot air. What do you do in a moment like that? Well, Tom told me he just hung on, hoping everyone else was as tired as he was, when all of a sudden, Johnson of Great Britain forged around on the right and went out in front by 2 yards. That pro-British crowd screaming wildly. Programs were going in the air. They were stomping their feet. What do you do when there's lactic acid in your muscles and practically all the oxygen's gone out of your blood? Young people, I say that's when you run on desire. That's when there's nothing else left but the deepest motivation, the emotion of a man, and the will of a man. And Courtney told me this. He said, all I could think of was, I had to win that race. I had to win that thing. And he picked those knees up, running through the hurt and fatigue. He began to close the gap on Johnson. At the rate of an inch per yard, he pulled back. With 10 yards left to go, they were shoulder to shoulder. I wish you could have seen Courtney's face. I've got slow motion pictures of it at home. I wish you could see a guy with desire etched out in every furrow of his brow. Eyes closed, teeth set. He'd have been a terrific advertisement for Pepsodent, because every tooth was bared, and with every muscle rippling, he drove towards the tape, lunged out and hit it, and collapsed on the track. He beat Johnson by 6 inches. New Olympic record, but the guy couldn't even stand up after the race was over. So tired, they had to revive him 5 times. He almost lapsed into unconsciousness. That's what I mean by desire. You define it. That's what I mean by it. When a man keeps on running when there's nothing left, when through hurt and pain, he battles on for victory. That's what desire is. When a man can keep going when it seems like it's impossible. I've listened to experts all over the world conjecture as to what makes a champion. And there are those who say, well, it's just hard work. If a kid works hard, he's bound to be good. Others say, oh, no, it's a great coach. If you've got a great coach, the coach will pull you out. That's what makes champions. Great coaching. Others say, oh, no, it's opportunity. You give a man the right opportunity, and he will emerge in that opportunity. Opportunity makes men. Others say, oh, no, it's just sheer God-given natural ability. If you've got the ability, it's bound to express itself. Others say, no, it's the word of encouragement, the pat on the back, the friendly word of inspiration. That's what makes champions. Well, men and women here tonight, we all know you've got to have all these things. No man will be great without any one of them. Sure, you've got to work thousands of hours. You've got to have a great coach. You've got to have opportunity, a community behind you, facilities. You've got to have ability. No man was ever great without talent. You've got to have inspiration. But you know, in 13 years of competitive sports, 3 Olympic Games, I found out one thing. There is something more fundamental. Something out of which all these other things emanate. And you show me a boy or a girl who's got a burning ambition to excel, a tremendous desire, and I'll show you a person who will work 10,000 hours. They'll beg for coaching. They'll seize every opportunity they can. They'll even create opportunity. They'll use every God-given talent they have to its utmost capacity. They'll drink in encouragement, inspiration. But on the contrary, show me a boy or a girl without it, and I can predict for you what'll happen to them. They just won't work. They won't take coaching. Opportunities, they'll never see them. Talents lie undiscovered within them, dormant, unexpressed. And inspiration falls upon them like water on a duck's back. Life requires an inner response. The Bible isn't kidding when it says this. Out of the heart come the issues of life. I've seen it in athlete after athlete, and the terrific thing about this is you don't get it by environment. You don't get it by heredity. You build it yourself. You build it with a great dream, with a great longing to be good, and then this thing becomes an obsession in your mind so that you think about it all the time, and then it crystallizes itself into a burning ambition. That's the way it emerges, kids, through great dreams and also in the doing. When you begin to work, and with each success, the desire grows, and the horizon broadens and widens, and then this desire builds and builds, and then you become the victim of it. If it's channeled in the right direction, it can be the most creative energy and power in the world. It will literally drive a man to greatness. But nobody can give it to you. You've got to build it yourself. Jesus understood this when he said these words, "With great desire, I have desired to eat this Passover feast with you." Now, he was talking about something infinitely greater, but you see, desire is at the heart of anything great. When he said this, "He that hungers and thirsts after righteousness shall be filled." He was getting at the pivotal center of human life. You've got to want something badly. No man will pay the price unless he does. That hymn is so right which says, "Prayer is the soul's sincere desire, uttered, unexpressed, the motion of the hidden fire that lies dormant in each breath." Build it, kids. Build it, men and women. It's the thing that can make you great in sport. Secondly, you've got to have a fighting heart. Now, I know some of you are going to think, "Boy, this sounds like a Canute Rockne pep talk." You probably think I'm going to say, "You got to fight, 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 fight." Well, if you think that's what I'm saying, just neglect it for a minute, the sport aspects of it. Let me say this. The greatest thing in life is a spirit that cannot be beaten. A heart that rises above difficulty. A will that no matter what happens, a man keeps right on going through hurt, pain. Here again, I can't describe this thing, but I've seen it in sport. I saw it in Melbourne, Australia. I wish you could have been there and watched 100,000 people roaring their approval. And a big old guy named Harold Connolly. If you'd have seen Harold Connolly, you'd have thought, "Well, no wonder the guy's the champ of the world, waving that big old right arm." If you'd have seen his bicep, you know what his bicep is, boys? Now, you girls won't be interested in this, but his right bicep was 18 inches. And if you don't think that's a big arm, you try to build one that big sometime. But that guy was waving that big old arm at the crowd. Well, you'd have thought, sure, he ought to be champion. Look at that bulging muscle. Look at it. But unknown to that crowd, hidden by a blue USA uniform, was a crippled left arm. One-third the size of his right, 4 inches shorter. When he was a kid, he broke that arm 13 times. And because of a freak bone disease at birth that never healed properly, it literally was a stump. That arm could have beaten Harold Connolly, but that kid wouldn't let it. He didn't make it an excuse. He did push-ups with that arm. He lifted weights with that arm. He did chin-ups. He did everything in his power to build it up. On his third throw in Melbourne, I watched that kid step into a 7-foot circle. 100,000 people watching breathlessly. Two Russians way out in front. They had broken the Olympic record. Harold had fouled twice. He had one last throw. I watched that kid in this dramatic moment as he put the crippled left hand on the handle of the hammer, got his right hand on top of it, the prayer that God would help him do his best. And then he got that 16-pound ball whirling around his head at a terrific 45-degree angle, whirling like a top. He turned three times and let that thing go with a terrific... You ever hear 100,000 people suck in air at the same time? As the ball whirls and whirls out there in that stadium, the dramatic moment, everyone in suspense... You talk about Sputnik, he would have beat him a long time ago. But anyway, that ball went out, 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 and finally it came down, splat. And then you hear it, the instantaneous of 100,000 people, and you look down at a guy as he lifts an old right arm in triumph. I say, when you see that kid, you see more than just a hammer thrower. You're seeing into the heart of life. What that kid did with that crippled left arm to become the champion of the world record holder, is what people can do in living if they've got the same kind of fight, the heart that battles on through difficulty. I saw it in a young girl named Shelley Mann. Oh, if you'd have been at this Olympic swimming stadium, you'd have probably been thinking, "Boy, look at that gal. She's got everything." She did, but I dare not get into that tonight. But anyway, you wouldn't have caught the meaning of what this gal had unless you'd have been with me about a week before. Oh, sure, you'd have probably been there, Star Spangled Banner playing, a girl crying, half smiling, the picture of health radiant. You'd have probably thought, "Well, sure, it's just another great athlete." unusual ability, reaching the top. But I ate with this girl 1 week before, a bunch of us in the dining hall eating, conversation going backwards and forth. The swimmers came in late. They'd worked late that night. And Shelly sat right opposite me, and just to stimulate conversation, I said, "Say, Shelly, how'd you get into swimming?" And this beautiful young 21-year-old girl looked me right in the eye and said, "Bob, when I was 5, I had polio." She had polio so badly, I got the story later, she could hardly move a muscle in her body. She went into a swimming pool not to become the champ of the world, but just to put a little bit of strength back in those feeble arms and legs. She tells the story how that she cried the day she got an arm out of the water. A major triumph just to get an arm out of the water. Her ambition was to swim one width, and through months of numbness and pain and work, that girl strained until she could finally stroke her way out one width, and then she swam 2 widths, and then she swam a length, and then she swam 2 lengths, and then 3, and then 4. The girl held 8 American records at one time. 8. In Melbourne, in the butterfly stroke, I watched her. The most difficult stroke there is, as that girl reached out and pulled her body through that water to hit the end of that pool in triumph by 8 inches over Nancy Ramsey of Seattle. You watch a girl standing there. Everyone in attention, the star-spangled banner playing, tears running down her cheeks, half laughing, half crying, clutching in her hand a gold medal that at one time she couldn't even hold up. You see what I mean when I say they've got a fighting heart. They don't only succeed in a swimming pool or on a track, kid. In life, they battle back no matter what happens to them. They overcome. I saw it in the Hungarian pistol shot. This guy who looked down that pistol barrel in 1952 in Helsinki, split the bullseye again and again and again, won the gold medal with his right hand, 6 months later lost it in an automobile wreck. And 3.5 years after the accident, that Hungarian boy came back, and with his left hand, he split the bullseye again and again and again and won his second gold medal with his left hand. Now, you don't beat guys like that. Life does not determine a champion. A champion always determines life. No matter what happens to a real champion, they battle back, they overcome, they struggle against the odds. I think of a boy, legs so terribly burned in a fire in his school that they claimed he'd never walk again, scar tissue unbelievable, skin grafts. This kid took hold of an old plow and with hands on that plow forced those scar tissued legs to function, and pretty soon he was walking, and then he began to jog, and then he began to run. Became one of the greatest runners of history. And they claimed he never walked. It was Glenn Cunningham. I think of a 9-year-old kid in Texas, struggling through the braces, polio. They claimed he'd never be normal, and he wasn't normal. He high jumped 7 feet and became one of the great pro basketball players in the league. That's what Buddy Davis did. I think of a Ben Hogan in a horrible automobile wreck, hurling his body out in front of his wife, Valerie. The horrible crash, the bus hitting his car head on. They claimed he'd never live. The guy lived. They claimed he'd never walk. He walked. They said he'd never play golf again. Hips so stiff, he'd never find full mobility. Nerve endings tied off in his legs. Ben Hogan, 1.5 years later, won the National Open Golf Championship of the United States of America. You can't beat guys like that. I think of Charlie Boswell, All-American halfback. He could run, throw, block, tackle, kick, anything. World War II, serving his country, a terrific explosion, and his eyes were ripped right out of his head. He'll never see again. Blinded for life. 205 pounds of muscle. He says that when he finally came to and realized he was blind, that he almost gave up. And again, he would break a cane over his knee as he just was about to quit. He'd break down and cry. This blind fella, at the insistence of a friend, took up golf. Swinging at a golf ball he had never seen, putting by sound as they rattled a metal object in the hole, Charlie Boswell, working through total darkness and blindness, won the world championship for blind golfers on his home course in Birmingham, Alabama. Kid shot 38. For 9 holes, totally blind. I don't know how many of you play golf. I play golf every chance I get. I just love this game. I got 20/20 vision. You know, I can see everything there is on the whole course, and that's exactly where I am, on the whole course. And I think of a guy without eyes in a game requiring depth, perspective, and vision, I think of a guy shooting almost par. You know what he says? I've heard this guy speak. You got to hear him smile, and he said, nothing can beat you. If you've got a fighting heart, nothing can beat you. You walk up and shake hands with this guy, and he says, good to see you again. You can't beat a guy like that, friend. You know, it's the symbol of the Olympic Games. Baron de Coubertin, the founder of the modern Olympics, put it in this slogan that is upon every Olympic stadium in all the world. The glory of the Olympic Games is not in the victory, but it's in taking part like a man. The essential thing in life is not conquering, but it's in the fight. It's in the fight. You show me a boy or girl who's got it. On a field, off the field, and I'll show you a boy or girl who will succeed in life. You've got to fight. It's the story of Abraham, Moses, David, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Jesus, Peter, Paul. Unbelievable difficulties, but fighting hard. And the world has changed because of it. This may sound strange to some of you young people. It may sound like strange theology to many of you, but I believe God sometimes gives a person a handicap, hurt, pain, in order to pull out the deepest within them. Learn what many champions have learned, that it isn't a crippled arm that counts, it's a crippled will that counts. It's not just being lame that is important, but it's being lame in desire and fight. It's what's within you that counts. Don't ever quit. You know, I see so many high school kids, great big strapping guys with muscles unbelievable. Potential, my glory, you look at them and you say, there's a world record holder. And you know what happens? Some little difficulty comes along and they get beaten and they throw in the towel and they whine, they whimper, they quit. Never realizing their great dream because they didn't have fight. All I can say is battle on. Victory, triumph comes to that boy or girl who just keeps battling on through the hurt to greatness. Thirdly, you've got to strive for perfection. You've got to strive for perfection. Now, this one is easy to say, isn't it? What makes a great champion? Well, they just keep trying to be better and better and better. That's very easy to say, isn't it? But young people and friends, I have seen them pay the price of this thing. I've seen them work hundreds of hours to get a quarter of an inch onto the end of a throw or at the end of a jump. I watched them train hundreds of hours to get a tenth of a second into their sprint. I watched men train, geometrically speaking, hundreds of times harder to get that little bit more. That's what makes them champions. They're not content with mediocrity, not content with being good. They want to be the best. And they keep reaching out for that maximum, going beyond the ceilings, going beyond what experts claim can be done, because they're striving for perfection. I've seen it in guys like Bobby Morrow. I wish you could have seen this young sprinter from Texas. I watched this guy work on starts one day. For 2 hours, for every day that I watched him, the kid worked on starts. And it was so odd, by contrast, Bobby would go down, the starter would say, get set, he would come up. He wouldn't move a muscle. He'd just wait for that gun to go off. Well, everybody else in the whole line was trying to beat the gun. They were going out, coming back, or rolling forward, trying to beat this thing. Well, it was so odd to watch Bobby because he wouldn't even quiver. Just wait for the gun. I nudged his coach, Oliver Jackson, and I said, say, Oliver, how come Bobby doesn't try to beat that gun? And Oliver took me by the arm. He said, Bob, in his whole competitive career, Bobby Morrow has never once jumped the gun. Because he thinks it's unchristian, unsportsmanlike to get a jump on a competitor. How do you like that one? I've competed in the decathlon 13 years, and I must admit I didn't think too much about that. Well, yes, I did too. Now, you know I did. But anyway, that guy preached to me one of the most effective sermons that I've ever had preached, and he never said a word. He showed me he was better off. I watched that kid, and I got a lesson. All these other guys trying to beat the gun, you watch it sometimes. They're going out, coming back. Every time the gun goes off, they're coming back. Now, you watch it every time. Or they're rolling forward until they're so far off balance that when the gun does go off, they're off balance and they come up with a lurch and they're gone. The second, third strike. Bobby, on the other hand, on perfect balance when that gun would go off, those knees were pumping, arms pumping. At 3 yards, it was all over. They might beat him out of the blocks, but at 3 yards, that guy was moving out in front. Perfect balance. I listened to him as he said to his coach, watch me from behind. If there's the slightest quiver, tell me. Imagine this. I bobble all over the track when I run, but this guy was worried about a quiver. Well, Jackson went back and he said, well, Bobby, on your third step, there was a little bit of a quiver. The guy worked until the tremor was gone. He measured every spike mark to the quarter of an inch. It had to be that close. I watched him exchange the baton with Thane Baker. Thane would come up and give Bobby this baton. He'd take that thing and roar around the curve up the straightaway. People would cry out, pretty good fellas, wonderful, forget it. He'd come back and very quietly say, well, Thane, pretty good, not good enough. We've got to perfect this thing. Well, you can say what you want. You can say preposterous, but I watched 100,000 people go to their feet as that gun went off. Mara was a yard behind at the start, but at 10 yards moving out in front, lower jaw so relaxed it was wobbling. Perfect form, down into the straightaway, into the tape. First gold medal. I watched him come around that curve and down the straightaway again. He just left his contemporary. Perfect balance, perfect stride, knees pumping like piston, into the tape for 2 gold medals. I watched him take that baton from Thane as he took the thing right at the exchange area mark, out of the area, around the curve, up the straightaway, into the tape again. A world record for himself and his teammates. 3 gold medals. Now, that won't mean anything to you, fellas, until you try to win one of them. Then you'll know what 3 of them are. You know what Sports Illustrated called Bobby Morrow as they named him the Athlete of the Year? 41 seconds of blazing perfection. You want to know what makes Olympic champions? That's it. 41 seconds of perfection. I saw it in tower diving. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever watched tower diving, but a gal or a guy goes off a thing up there above that rafter. They do 3.5 flips. You ever seen it? Any of you here ever tried it just once? Anyone ever gone off a 35-foot tower? Well, you just haven't lived until you tried it just once. No kidding, it's something you'll never forget. I watched those guys and gals go off that thing 3.5 flips, and they'd split the water like a bullseye. They never missed. You'd see these young girls go off, lean back into a double gainer, and split that water. Or you'd watch them as they do a double twisting 1.5 and hit that one. What, it all looks so easy. And I thought, well, now, if girls can do that, I ought to be able to do that. And I thought to myself, well, it's only twice 15 feet or so. So one day I got my suit on jauntily, and I made my way up this ladder, you know, going through all the horseplay, woo, woo, and all this. My buddies down there were just waiting for the kill, but I went right on up the thing, you know. I was feeling rather gay about the thing when I made my mistake. I looked down. When you do it, fellas, don't look down. It's 5 times higher. Well, I would have gone right back down that ladder again, but for the fact there were a bunch of girls down there, and I had to prove my masculinity. So I took one big gulp, and I went off this thing, and you know I was wrong. The first 5 feet is tremendous. No kidding. You can see everything. It's a beautiful view. But watch out for that last 30 feet. Now, I can't put it into words. Actually, it's a whistle going by your ear. It's a terrific whoosh. And you think you're there and you've still got 20 feet to go. Believe me, if you're religious, it comes out about right then. And all of a sudden you hit, blam, and then you hit the bottom of the pool, blam. Well, I came back up from the bottom of that pool, and believe you me, two things burned themselves in my mind. One, I'd never do it again. Secondly, I would appreciate those kids who did, especially a girl, Pat McCormick. I wish you could have seen this young housewife from Long Beach, California. She never missed. She was absolutely poetry in motion. It looked as though she ruled the waves down. It was fantastic. She would split that water perfectly. Every time she'd come up out of the water, people would roar their approval, and the stadium was packed every day, not only the Olympic day, but every day. Well, that girl would come out of the pool, and her coach would put his arm around her. I should tell you, he happens to be her husband. But anyway, he'd put his arm around her, and he'd say, now, Pat, it was a good dive, but your toe wasn't quite pointed. Well, he would say, your tuck wasn't quite right. You went in the water a little bit askew. This girl would listen patiently, and I'm not exaggerating. She'd go up that tower 25, 30 times. She'd go off that thing working on pointing her toe. Can you believe it? Here I was so glad just to have all 10 of mine left. And that girl was worried about pointing one of the confounded things. Well, I watched her work out 6-8 hours a day sometimes. She never left the pool. Training, training. Well, she won 2 gold medals in Helsinki, Finland. And 6 months after giving birth to a lovely baby boy, she won those same two gold medals again. You couldn't beat her. They named her the outstanding woman athlete of the year. In talking with her, this is what she said to me, Bob. With every dive, I strive to be better. With every dive, I strive to be better. Kids, you want a philosophy of life. There it is, wrapped up in a nutshell. In every endeavor, just strive to be a little bit better. I tell you, it's not so much where you are that counts. It's the direction in which you're heading. And if you're getting a little bit better, going up, 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 you're on your way to a world record. You may wonder why they have this philosophy. I can tell you why. They get beat if they don't. I watch guys in 100 meters, like in 52 in Helsinki. I watched 8 guys blaze down a straightaway, 6 of them almost together. They all lunged out. The winner won by a nose. I watched George Brown in the broad jump blaze down that straightaway to hit that takeoff board. As he hit that thing, went up and out and bent in and landed in the sand, the roar of the crowd. He jumped up in joy. He was a foot and a half beyond anybody else. But he looked back and a red flag was waving. He had fouled by an eighth of an inch. Now you go up to that kid rubbing the sand, crying on his last jump. Put your arm around him and say, well, George, don't worry, you only fouled by an eighth of an inch. He'll tell you he didn't even place. The greatest broad jumper in the world didn't even place. He fouled 4 times by an eighth of an inch. You see what a striving for perfection means? It can be the difference between victory and defeat. I watched Gary Tobias go off that tower. 10 almost perfect dives, but on one dive his feet came apart for a split second, pulled him together, went back in the water, but he lost to Joaquin Capi of Mexico by 3/1,000th of a point. Those feet coming apart was the difference. You see that, kids, and you understand what it means. I wish you could talk to Fortune as to how he broke that world record. I think he would tell you that being small for this event, relatively speaking, that he got to the place where his form was absolutely perfect. I have watched this guy work on the most minute details to the point where he's trying to get just the shoulder movement into the thing at the end. I hope you'll forgive this personal reference, but you know, I won 2 Olympic gold medals. I don't want to talk about that, but kids, just so you get the message, do you know how much I won both of those medals by? Well, look real close. 3/4 of an inch the first time, and an inch the second time. And the second time, I hit the crossbar on the third trial. The crossbar bounced, weaved, slid, and hung on by 1/4 of an inch. Don't tell me that little tiny bit more put into a jump doesn't pay off. Don't tell me the hours spent in just a flyaway or getting an arm up doesn't mean. That makes me think of why I never broke a world record. On the contrary, it's cost me. I've been up over 15.9 1/2 in Milwaukee. I was clear over the thing, had the jump, and my elbow caught the crossbar and it shimmied off. The next jump, I caught it with my thumb and the thing shimmied off. Little things can beat you. Little things can beat you. You know why I don't drink? I've seen men become alcoholics with one drink. This is why I don't smoke, because I think it keeps you from the superlative effort that life requires for greatness. Young people, this is why I say to young kids, don't ruin your life with one little tiny mistake. I've seen kids do this. All I'm suggesting is this. Just keep striving to be a little bit better. I don't want to frustrate anybody here, but here's the secret. If you're studying, read one page more. Just keep reaching out a little bit farther. If you're striving to be great as a salesman, just work that little bit harder. In your home life, strive to be just a little bit more loving. Here is the secret of greatness. It's part of the greatest challenge ever given mankind. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Kids, it's what makes champions. They keep striving for that maximum, that ultimate perfection. And lastly, and I close with this, I saw a spiritual dimension in Melbourne. Now, some of you are probably going to think, oh, here we go off into the wild blue yonder. We're going to talk about the spiritual world, the world of ghosts and ethereal somethings out here. I don't mean that, kids. Or maybe some of you think, here we get to muscular Christianity, and you probably think it's like the guy who was running the mile race, and he'd finished 3 laps, and his legs were just about to give way, and he had a whole lap left to go, and he lifted up his eyes to God, and he said, "Oh, God, you pick him up, and I'll put him down." Well, that's the attitude of a lot of people in sports, you know. "Oh, God, you pick him up, and I'll just go along for the ride." But it isn't that. It's more a prayer like this: "Oh, God, you help me pick him up, and together we'll pick him up, and together we'll put him down." I've listened and talked to a lot of great athletes. I wish you could talk to an Otto Graham, the world's greatest pro quarterback in football. And he said this: "I've never gone on a gridiron in my life, but what I prayed, God would help me do my best." I wish you could listen to a Duke Walker, 3 times All-American, one of the great pro halfbacks. He said, "I'm not ashamed of my faith, and God, I have never gone on that field, but what I prayed." A Don Moomaw, 2 times All-American, used to pray before every play. A Deacon Dan Cowher, a Billy Wade. I think of guys like Carl Erskine and Alvin Dark and George Kell and Jackie Robinson and Robin Roberts and so many others. Men who pray. I saw it in Melbourne. I'll never forget Bobby Morrow. One day in practice, I put my arm on his shoulder and I said, "Say, Bobby, you ever pray when you run?" And this tremendous kid looked up over his shoulder and said, "Bob, I've never ran a race in my life, but what I've always asked God to help me do my best." You watch a guy superlatively running down that track with more than just muscle. I wish you could have seen it in Milt Camel. 6'4", 220 pounds. This guy runs 109.4. Runs the hurdles in 13.4. On his way to a new world record in the decathlon, but in the pole vault, the guy goofs. Misses by 2 feet what he should have jumped. And I listened to old Milt as he missed his step on that last trial. The crossbar came off. He landed in the sawdust in a heap, and he came up out of that thing. The moan of the crowd in the background as he hit his hand saying, "How could I have done it? How could I have done it to myself?" And the tears ran down his cheeks, sawdust running off his shoulder as the guy was beaten. You think these are sissy tears? Crush a soup can in his hand. He's that strong. 220 pounds of nothing but muscle and power. I've seen it in his back because I've been running behind him all the way. I watched this guy. But he was beaten. You talk about a guy beaten, shoulder slouched. He walked off the field. Well, Rafer and I had to go on in the pole vault. The javelin was coming up. We walked into that locker room together to get milk. He still had his head in his hand, shaking his head, when all of a sudden he slipped off the bench and he prayed, "Oh, God, if you'll help me come back, I'll give you the praise and the glory." And that guy straightened up. He went back out on that field, got a javelin, roared down the javelin runaway, planted those feet, and let it go 25 feet farther than his farthest throw ever. Ran his fastest 1,500 meters through hurt and pain to hit the tape-breaking Bob Mathias Olympic record. You help a guy around the track is all he can say in between the gasps. "The Lord help me, Bob. The Lord help me. The Lord help me." You watch a guy skim over the hurdles like Lee Calhoun. As he skims over that last hurdle and lunges into the tape to beat Jack Davis by 4 inches, you go up to congratulate him and he throws his arm around you and says, "Bob, I was praying all the way. I was praying all the way." He was also doing a lot of running, but that guy was praying all the way. You see it in guys like Craig Bell in broad jump camp, who says, "Give God the credit." Harold Conley says, "I've always prayed a Pat McCormick. I never fail to pray that God will help me do my best." It's that kind of a thing I think. I saw it in Ron Delaney, and I close with this last story. 102,000 people jam-packed into that audience. You couldn't have gotten another person in that stadium if you'd have tried. All out to watch John Landy, the hero of Australia, as he came off the curve with only 110 yards left to go. Everyone cheering and roaring for their hero. Behind him was Nielsen of Denmark. Coming up from 9th place was a stoical kid from Ireland, Ron Delaney. Ron Delaney, there wasn't an expression on his face, but with knees pumping like pistons, he went by Nielsen. He went by Landy into the tape to win the thing. The roar of the crowd followed by a hush. Delaney, with his head in his hand, was kneeling down, thanking God for the victory. That's what I mean by a spiritual dimension. I've seen it in some of the greatest ones. Even those rough, tough guys you'd think wouldn't have it, like Jesse Owens, he says, "Every man has a secret prayer. Every man has a secret prayer." I believe, from my own personal experience, kids, and I've always prayed, never to win, always that God would help me do my best. And I've always prayed for my competition, too. This may stagger you. But I found that when they go higher, it pushes you higher. And I've come out of the sport with more than just medals. I've got some wonderful friends, too. But all I'm saying is this. The human life reaches its greatest achievement when the divine dimension touches that life and pulls it out. When you're divinely motivated, it makes a difference. Well, this is what I saw in Melbourne. I saw a burning desire to win, pay off in gold medals. I saw a fighting heart, men struggling against the odds to conquer. I saw a striving for perfection, the difference between victory and defeat. I saw a spiritual dimension, men praying, kneeling down, men asking for a divine power to help them live up to the best within them. I believe these are the basic ingredients of life. We're all running a great race. Every boy and girl, every man and woman here is involved in a great race. We're in a great game. It's the race and game of life. I don't know what your endeavor is, whether it's the art world, the world of music, whether it's the world of scholarship, knowledge, wisdom, whether it's the world of spirituality, character, morality, the kingdom of God. I only know this. This is what you've got to have. Desire, faith, a striving to be better, and a spiritual dimension, a power greater than your own. I hope that you'll put this into your life. You alone can do it. And I hope that you'll go out into this tremendous game and race, and that when it's all through, after you've put everything you can into the life stream of humanity, after you have lived up to this great potential that God has given you, I hope you can say what one of the greatest athletes of the Spirit said when he closed his life by saying this: I have fought a good fight. I have finished my race, and henceforth there's laid up for me a crown of righteousness. Do that, young people. Fight a good fight. Finish your race and receive the greatest crown there is, immortal life with him. Thank you, Mr. Pope.
En 1957, la ciudad de Nueva York recibió un impacto terrible.
New York City received a terrible impact.
El germen de la delincuencia juvenil se paró firme.
The germ of juvenile delinquency was firm there.
Y empezó a hacer guerra contra todo aquello que era autoridad.
And started to declare war against everything that was authority.
Gente moría en las calles.
People would die on the streets.
Jóvenes se mataban los unos a los otros.
Teenagers would kill one another.
La ciudad no sabía qué hacer.
The city did not know what to do.
En una condición,
it was in such a condition
que se reunió el cuerpo ejecutivo de Brooklyn, Manhattan, y el Bronx.
The executive board from the boroughs of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Brooklyn and Bronx got together.
Para tratar el problema de esta ciudad.
To deal with this problem of the city.
Se reunieron todos.
They all gathered.
Y empezaron a discutirlo.
And they started to discuss this problem.
Todos llegaron a una conclusión.
They all came to one conclusion.
Tiene que venir el alcalde.
The mayor has to come.
Para que dé su autoridad.
So that he gives his authority.
Entonces el mayor vino allí.
Then the mayor came.
Pero nada se pudo resolver.
But nothing was able to be accomplished.
Luego el presidente de esta reunión,
then the president of this meeting,
junto con el alcalde,
along with the mayor,
fueron hacia el gobernador, el señor Rockefeller.
They went to the governor, Mr. Rockefeller,
para ver si él podía demandar cierta cantidad de dinero.
To see if he could appropriate a certain amount of money.
Ellos pensaron esta situación.
They thought seriously about this situation.
Si nosotros hacemos clubes en todas las esquinas de New York,
and they thought if they could make clubs in every corner of New York,
esto iba a aguantar un poco la delincuencia juvenil.
Would detain a little juvenile delinquency.
Las pandillas no tenían que estar en las calles.
Then the gangs wouldn't have to be in the streets.
No tenían que estar dando peligro en las calles.
They wouldn't be endangering the lives on the streets.
Sucedió que entonces empezaron a poner clubs en toda la ciudad de New York.
It so happened that they started to build clubs in all New York City.
Y todas las pandillas se reunían en estos clubes.
And all the gangs would meet in these clubs.
Pero esto duró casi dos meses.
But this only lasted approximately 2 months.
Empezaron a pelearse los clubes con los otros clubes.
Then the clubs started to fight one another.
Y empezaron a quemar todos los clubes.
And they started to burn out all the clubs.
Por las noches venían carros.
At night cars would come.
Y bombas de gasolina tiraban
they
a esos lugares.
Gasoline bombs to these clubs.
Muchos fueron destruidos.
Many were destroyed.
Enseguida pararon.
Then they stopped.
Porque allí lo que hacían estos muchachos eran esto.
This is what these kids would do there.
Le pusieron una bellonera.
They would put a record player there, one of these jukeboxes.
Y allí ellos ponían cada un bellón, quizás 10 centavos o 25 centavos.
They would put there a dime or 25 cents.
Y allí bailaban.
They would dance there.
Bebían.
They would drink.
Soda.
Soda.
Y hacían todas las cosas menos llegar a un estado en la cual la corrupción.
They would do many things except to come to the stage of corruption.
Pero esto duraba desde las 6 a las 12.
But this would last from 6 through 12.
Y después que salían, nadie sabía lo que hacían estos muchachos.
And after they would leave the club, no one knew what those kids would do.
Entonces pasaron una ley que no se pusieran más clubes.
Then they passed a law that no more clubs be established.
Y no se pudo hacer nada.
Then nothing could be made.
Con la situación en New York.
With the situation in New York.
Hablo porque en esa situación yo en ese momento me encontraba yo.
I speak by experience because I was there when this took place.
Porque nosotros mismos destruimos.
Because we ourselves destroyed.
Porque nosotros mismos ya estábamos cansados de tantos clubes.
Because we ourselves were tired of so many clubs.
Y empezamos a explotarlos con bombas de gasolina.
We started to explode them with gasoline bombs.
Ahora yo quiero hacer mención sobre esto.
Now I want to mention something.
Para mí va a ser duro poder recordar un pasado.
For me it'll be hard to remember a past.
Y poder yo pensar en algo que ya es pasado.
And to think of something that is of the past already.
Algo el cual quizás me pone a veces triste.
Something that probably makes me get sad.
Y quizás no tuviera la vergüenza o me sentiría avergonzado de decirlo.
Probably I might be ashamed to mention it.
Porque fueron tantas las cosas que pasaron.
Because there were so many things that took place.
Fueron los momentos más terribles de sufrimiento.
Were the moments these of greatest suffering for me.
Donde el dolor.
Where pain.
Donde la miseria.
Where misery.
La disolución.
Dissolution.
El quebrantamiento.
And breaking apart.
Todas estas cosas.
All of these things.
Hicieron posesión de toda mi vida.
They took possession of my life.
Yo era humano.
I was human.
Pero no podía yo ver la condición en la cual estaba viviendo.
But I couldn't realize the condition in which I was living in.
Pero años atrás.
But years back.
Recuerdo que vengo de la ciudad, de una isla de Puerto Rico.
I do recall that I come from the island of Puerto Rico.
Un hogar el cual, pese a decirlo así, estaba destruyéndose.
It is sad to mention that this home was being destroyed.
No había paz en este hogar.
There was no peace in this home.
Sino lo que había era destrucción.
All that existed there was destruction.
Mi papá era presidente de una mesa de espiritistas.
My father presided a spiritualist session.
Y tenía un centro bien grande.
And he had a great center there.
Mi padre era procurado por toda la isla.
My father was solicited by many people in that island.
Y muchas personas quizás ignorantes lo adoraban como un dios.
And probably many ignorant people adored him like a god.
Le traían muchas cosas.
They would bring to him many things.
Mi madre era una medium.
My mother was a medium.
Echaba la suerte de las cartas.
She would read the fortune with the cards.
Ella le daba la buena suerte y la mala suerte
she
a la gente.
She was able to read the bad and the good luck of the people.
Pero fueron muchas veces cuando mis ojos presenciaron.
But it was many of the times that my own eyes were able to witness.
Odio en aquel hogar.
Where there was hatred in this home.
El hijo se levantaba contra el padre.
The son would be against the father.
Y el padre contra el hijo.
And the father against the son.
No esforzaban a nosotros a ir a estos servicios.
They would force us to come to these sessions.
Y teníamos que estar allí.
And we had to be there.
Y con nuestros propios ojos llenos de espanto y de miedo.
And somewhat amazed with our own eyes and full of fear we would see.
Aquellas tremendas manifestaciones
those
que tomaban lugar.
Manifestations that would take place.
Como la gente era movida por una sensación.
How the people were moved by a sensation. Y esta sensación tomaba lugar de todo el cuerpo de aquellas personas.
And the sensation would possess the entire body of these people.
Unos gritaban.
Some would scream.
Unos botaban balas por las bocas.
Some would throw foam through their mouths.
Y ahí estaban bajo un éxtasis.
And they were under an ecstasis.
En la cual se quedaban tiempo.
In which they would be for unlimited
bastante
times.
Bastante largos.
Unlimited times.
Recuerdo que nosotros tuvimos que rebelarnos sobre este asunto.
I recall that we had to rebel against the situation.
Y aunque yo era un muchachito pequeño, como de 7 años,
I was a small lad of the age of 7,
notwithstanding, aquello ya me tenía preocupado.
This had me somewhat worried.
Creé quizás un complejo.
And this probably created in me a complex.
Tenía miedo de la noche.
I was afraid of night.
Tenía miedo de la oscuridad.
I was fearful of darkness.
Tenía miedo de toda aquella cosa que pudiera ser peligrosa.
I was fearful of all things that could be hazardous.
Pero sobre todas las cosas.
But above all things.
Un día vengo jugando con una bola.
One day I came playing with a ball.
Como era inocente y era un muchacho tierno.
As I was a tender lad and somewhat innocent.
No tenía experiencia de la vida.
I didn't have any experience of life.
Quería mucho a mi madre.
I loved my mother very much.
Quería mucho a mi padre.
I loved my father very much.
Yo no podía comprender aquel espíritu o aquella atmósfera.
I couldn't understand this atmosphere and this spirit.
Quizás no tenía.
Probably I didn't have.
Es bastante entendimiento para comprender.
Enough understanding to define the situation.
Okay, era yo bastante pequeño.
Or rather that I was rather small.
Cuando vine jugando con esta bolita,
when I came playing with this little ball,
había visita en mi hogar.
There was company in my home.
Mientras que estaban hablando allí,
they were conversing there.
Entré yo hacia adentro.
I came inside.
Y cuando entré así, una señora se me llamó a mí.
And when I came in, a lady pointed out to me.
Y me dijo a mi mamá que si yo me parecía a ella.
She said to my mother, doesn't he look like you?
Yo esperando una palabra de elogio.
I was expecting a word of praise.
Unas palabras de agradecimiento.
Some words of gratitude.
Pero no fue así.
But it wasn't so.
Los labios de mi madre empezaron a abrirse.
The lips of my mother started to open.
Vi su rostro que mudeció.
And I saw that her countenance was hard.
Luego se me quedó mirando.
Then she stared at me.
Y me dijo, este no es mi hijo.
And she said, this is not my son.
No lo querido.
I have never liked him.
Parece que todo aquello hizo un impacto en mí.
Looks like all of this made a tremendous impact in my life.
Busqué una salida para tratar de correr.
I tried to find an avenue of escape so I could run.
Y entonces lo único que pude hacer fue.
And then the only thing I was able to do was
correr hacia este cuarto.
Run to this room.
Y allí quedarme.
And there remain.
Quedándome llorando.
Remaining there crying.
Tratando de aguantar aquel sollozo.
Trying to contain my sobbing.
Y estuve como 2 horas.
And I was there about 2 hours.
Mis ojos estaban colorados.
My eyes were red.
Mis ojos ya no podían botar más lágrimas.
My eyes couldn't shed no more tears.
Me levanté de aquella cama.
I rose up from that bed.
Corrí donde estaba mi madre.
I ran to where my mother was.
Y así un niño de 8 años.
And there a lad of 8 years of old.
Le dije la odio con todo el corazón.
I hate you with all my heart.
Y entonces así me fui.
And that, in this fashion I went.
Ya no era el mismo Nicky.
I wasn't the same Nicky anymore.
Cuando yo dije aquellas palabras,
when I said these words,
era un Nicky quebrantado.
It was a broken Nicky.
Un Nicky lleno de dolor.
It was a Nicky full of pain.
Un Nicky lleno de odio.
A Nicky full of hatred.
Entonces sucedió.
Then it happened.
Que ya no podía estar viviendo en mi hogar.
That I couldn't keep living in my home.
Tenía que hacer cualquier avance que viniese.
I had to do anything that was in my power to do.
Y lo único que estaba esperando que ya fuera grande para irme.
The only thing I was waiting for was to be old enough in order to leave the home.
Llegó el momento.
Then the moment came.
Cuando tuve que salir de la isla de Puerto Rico.
When I had to leave the island of Puerto Rico.
Y un muchacho sin experiencia llegó a la ciudad de New York.
And a kid without experience arrived at New York City.
Ningunos brazos abrieron para recibirme.
No open arms were there to receive me.
Tenía yo que hacer de mi propia fuerza todo lo posible.
I had to support myself with, of my own.
Y vivir la vida como viniese.
And live life as it came to me.
Cogí aquellas maletas.
I took those luggages.
Yo empecé a caminar por las calles de New York.
And I started to walk through the streets of New York.
No tenía lugar.
I didn't have a place where to sleep.
No tenía lugar donde yo pudiera comer.
I didn't have a place where to eat.
No tenía dinero en mi bolsillo.
I didn't have money in my pocket.
Y tenía que dormir a veces en los parques.
And sometimes I had to live and sleep in the parks.
Muchas veces en los rufos.
Many times on the rooftops.
Muchas veces en los subways.
Many times in the subways.
Muchas veces pasé frío.
Many times I was suffering cold.
Muchas veces sufrí hambre.
Many times I suffered hunger.
Y vivía como alguien que no podía entender las cosas.
And I lived in a world as of someone that doesn't understand things.
Levantaba mis ojos hacia los cielos.
I would raise my eyes up to heaven.
Y parecía que los cielos estaban oscuros.
And it seemed as if the heavens were darkened.
Lo único que podía oír alrededor era ruido.
The only thing that I could hear around me was noise.
Y el cambio de las luces.
And the changes of the lights.
Que cambiaban de verde a rojo.
That they would change from green to red.
¿Cuántas veces tenía que meterme a los restaurantes?
How many times I would have to go into the restaurant.
Y allí pedí una comida.
The food.
Y desesperado comerme esa comida.
Desperately eat this food.
Y esperar que ya todo el mesero se fuese.
And watch the waitress.
Y después salir corriendo.
And then sneak out.
Y aunque me gritaban, todavía seguía corriendo.
And even if they would shout at me and yell, I would keep on running.
No obstante.
Notwithstanding.
No podía entender.
I couldn't understand.
Empecé a odiar a la humanidad.
I started to hate humanity.
No quería recordar nada de mi familia.
I didn't want to recall anything of my family.
Odiaba a todo el mundo.
I hated everybody.
Y estaba caminando por las calles.
And I was walking through the streets.
Un día estaba en esta esquina.
One day I was in this corner.
Estaba haciendo frío, era un lugar de invierno.
It was very cold, it was winter time.
De pronto, cuando estaba en esta esquina,
suddenly, as I was standing in this corner,
vi un amigo mío llamado Pico.
A friend of mine by the name of Pico came.
Me dijo, Nicky, yo quisiera que viniese a un baile.
He said, Nicky, I wish you could come over to a dance.
En este baile,
in this dance,
vas a conocer esta ganga llamada los Mau Mau Chaplains.
You will know and meet the Mau Mau Chaplains.
Yo había leído los periódicos la reputación de esta ganga.
I had read of their reputation in the newspapers.
Era una ganga de las más temidas en la ciudad de New York.
It was one of the most horrible gangs of New York.
Era una de las gangas de las pandillas a las cuales le tenían miedo.
It was one of the gangs that everyone was afraid of.
Que peleaba contra la policía.
They would fight against the cops.
Implantó el terror en la mente de muchos jóvenes.
They implanted terror in the minds of many teenagers.
Acepté la invitación.
I accepted the invitation.
Fui con Pico.
I went with Pico.
Cuando entré a este lugar no había luces.
When I came to this place there were no lights.
Lo único que se escuchaba era un tocadiscos.
The only thing that I could hear was a record player.
Y pasos.
And steps.
Y se podía oler el fumar de la marihuana.
And I smelled marijuana smoke.
Muchachas con bebidas en sus manos.
Girls with liquor in their hands.
Y muchachos.
And boys.
Dando la corrupción más terrible en estos momentos.
Corruption at this hour.
Yo entendía que el ambiente porque estaba en el mundo.
I understood this environment because I was in the world.
No conocía otro ambiente.
I didn't know no other environment.
No hizo un efecto a mí mental aquello.
It didn't do any mental effect in me.
Porque aquello era lo que yo estaba haciendo.
Because this was what I was doing.
Fui, conocí al presidente.
I went and I met the gang leader.
Entonces allí el presidente me hizo la invitación de entrar a la ganga.
And there the gang leader invited me to become member of this gang.
Empecé a decirle, dame 3 días.
And he started saying, and then I said to him, give me 3 days.
Y en esos 3 días yo te digo si yo voy a entrar a la ganga.
And in these 3 days I will answer if I will or not join the gang.
Entonces sucedió.
Then it happened.
Que yo me fui.
That I went.
Pero después empecé a pensar.
But then I started...